Hey everybody, this is Wade with Wade for Wireless again, and welcome back to part two of the Vicky Kosiorg interview. I appreciate your patience, sorry it was so long, but I'm telling you, she's just a joy to be around. She's so pleasant, and you get to hear more about her story and how she interviewed the pilots, and just, I mean, it's a three-year venture. I mean, that is so amazing to me that she had the patience for 3 years to get to the bottom of this. And then she was able to put all her notes together. And to me, I liked the book. You know, obviously it was the building of the towers that attracted me, but it was also the stories in it. I mean, there's more than just the stories of the Bull Knox Towers, but she also tells, you know, the story of Tony the Tower Builder, which, again, I can really relate to this guy's life. And, he had a happy ending. God bless him. And, you know, she tells the story of the strobe light, which just intrigued her, and, you know, you would get really curious. And the one thing that I think most of you, especially you engineers and climbers, were so busy, wouldn't you love to be able to take the time to research something like this? And Vicky did. She took the time. She stayed interested in it to the end. She completed it to the end. And I give her a lot of credit for that. All right? So here's part two. Enjoy.
Let's talk about, you talk about your faith, and then it just seems like in this book, everywhere you turn, you ran into people that had stories for you, like pilots, all these airline pilots you ran into. You know, it's funny. I mean, everywhere you went, somebody had a piece of your puzzle about, I know we're talking about the strobe lights more now, but I just thought that was amazing.
Well, you know, and then I love how you put that. It was almost like I was walking through a human jigsaw puzzle, because there were three big mysteries I was trying to solve. One of which was, why was the tower designed the way it was designed? Why did WBT choose to rebuild this archaic tower, and especially without blueprints? And why was there this rotating aircraft beacon on the transmitter building that for 80 years that no one knew why it was there or what its purpose was? It was not to light the towers. We knew that. There were other lights on the towers, although some people tried to convince me it was to light the towers. It never made sense to me for various reasons that I won't go into. But so there's these three mysteries, and I've become a detective now, and I was hooked. And so I took 3 years, two really active years of research to solve these mysteries. And again, I'm a layperson, know nothing about World War II, and a lot of it had to do with World War II navigation. Aviation navigation was the route that I ended up taking to solve the puzzle. But know nothing about towers, know nothing about World War II, know nothing about aviation or aviation navigation. But just everywhere I would go, serendipitously, I would run into someone who would say, hey, I can tell you about so-and-so, or would introduce me to someone. And they would have this tiny piece of the puzzle that I would fit in. You know, I have just notes, voluminous notes, and I trying to piece together what everybody, one by one, what people are telling me, and ultimately solved all three of the mysteries. And it was, I truly saw the hand of God, just miraculous things. One of the most interesting ones was the records for the rotating beacon. They apparently were lost, as well as the blueprints for the towers. No one could find any record of why this beacon was installed, who installed it, and what its purpose was. And one day, the chief engineer, who was actually initially not very helpful to me because he didn't want to speculate, he was just too busy. He was a kind man. He was just too busy to deal with this crazy person who wanted to find out about something that even the radio station knew nothing about.
Yeah.
One day he said he went to sit down at his desk long after he had put me off and said, you know, that the records are gone, I'm not going to speculate, basically buzz off. And then he finds this folder on his desk filled with information about the beacon. Didn't tell me everything, but it gave us a little bit closer approximation of when it had been installed. They were daily logs, and the beacon is mentioned over and over again in these daily logs. And there were pictures that led to all kinds of other clues, and the pictures were from the time period where the beacon was installed.
Wow.
And he, to this day, doesn't know where that folder came from. Doesn't know who put it on his desk. Yeah, does it? He hadn't been, well, as far as I know, he hadn't been asking about it, but he asked all the likely suspects, and he said no one knew where that folder came from.
Yeah, that was in your book, too. It was on his desk, and he's asking around, who laid this here? Nobody knew. It's a big mystery.
Right.
But it helped you out, so.
Yeah, so many people on the Internet that I met, just through, you know, I'd email them. They'd have a website like yours. If you had had that website up then, I certainly would have emailed you and said, hey, I need some information about these towers. So many people would take the time to write back to me, some of them for months and ongoing, doing research for me, sending me books. And I would nag them, and just, I would be relentless, and I would, these are the experts, but I would constantly question them and say, you know, say, this doesn't make sense, and I don't agree with you. And none of them ever got angry with me, and none of them ever hung up on me. They all just stuck with me. And in the end, you know, really it was a joint effort. We were able to come to, what turned out to be the correct, we're pretty sure it's the correct conclusion.
It just sounds like a lot of people that you contacted just became as interested as you did. They wanted to solve the mystery too. That's what it seemed like to me. They wanted to know about the towers, the beacon.
Right.
They were just trying to figure it all out, because it just seems like, I guess because, you know, these World War II guys had such passion about history. I think to them, they just wanted to solve it as much as you did. It just seems that way. I can't believe how many pilots you talked to. I mean, how many were there? Were there 10?
I talked to far more than I put in the book. And someday maybe I will write another book just about their experiences. But I talked to maybe 20 World War II aviators. They would have been pilots, navigators, bombardiers, some of them. But all of them had, you know, been up in the airplane, and I was hoping to find out more about whether they used AM radio signals to navigate back during the war days, because that was giving me clues to the beacon, why the aircraft beacon was there. But they just were such wonderful people, for the same sort of people as Tony's parents were that, you know, that generation was just, they were filled with faith, love of family, love of country, the desire for excellence, and a lust for knowledge, and a despair that so many young people today don't care about history. And so I can't tell you how many times I heard them when I would say, I have so much enjoyed talking to you. Thank you so much for talking with me. And they would say, you know, no one talks to us about this stuff, and we're all dying. And it's so sad, because our stories are dying with us.
It's, you know, it's funny, World War II, well, you got it. It's I would say two generations now. And you're right. It's just being forgotten. And I don't think anyone understands, you know, a world war, you know, including me. It's hard for me to imagine.
Right.
I mean, I had a lot of friends that were in, I have a few friends that were in Vietnam and a few in Korea. And I have a lot of friends that were over in the Gulf, you know, for both Gulf wars. But I just can't imagine, you know, it was a world war, and times were so hard here in America, whereas a lot of the other wars, they affect us, especially if you know somebody.
Right.
But we didn't go through, I don't know what you'd say, we didn't go through the same thing that they did in World War II, because we had to conserve every piece of copper. We had to conserve silver. We had to, we just had to, all the men were gone, you know. You know what I mean? I mean, a majority of the men were overseas fighting. There were enough here to keep things going.
Right.
It
was
just
really a unified effort in a way that I don't think any of our other wars were. You know, the whole country had to really pull together, and they did. But there was a different sense of what it meant to be, I think, an American, a stronger national, sense than there appears to be now. But yet they I saw that over and over and over again. The experience when I went in to talk with some old time aviators at an old aviation museum here, and they were all some of them were World War II vets. Not all of them. I don't think one guy was, but they were all in their 80s and 90s. And this old museum, old air museum, with wall-to-wall books, kind of musty smelling, and I walk in and these four or five elderly gentlemen in their 80s and 90s just flock around me. You can tell I'm maybe the first person that walked in that museum, certainly that week, if not that month. and they were so thrilled to talk to me, and they start pulling out books and maps and old postcards of other old beacons. At that point, I'm thinking my beacon is an airmail beacon, and they help me to research the whole airmail system, which so many people don't know anything about, and it is fascinating. Do you know that when our pilots first started flying across the country, of course, there's an electrical grid or anything like that. This is in the 1920s, and to deliver the mail. And so for those first pilots, people all along the route across the country would light bonfires every 10 miles so the pilots would know where they were. And then those bonfires were replaced by these airmail beacons every 10 miles. And
wow.
And in fact, there were plenty of them. I finally found the old airmail beacon route, which took a lot of digging on my part. And again, my airmail expert said, no, there were none in Charlotte, wasn't on the route. Well, I came across and finally found a document with pictures that showed, yes, indeed it was. And there were three airmail beacons off of the main route. And so that for a long time, I suspected that that's what the beacon on WBT transmitter building was. But in the process of tracking that down, I learned all about this incredible time in American history. And it was through our pilots and the skills they developed and the instruments they developed during our airmail days that made them such extraordinary pilots during the war. So everything is so interconnected, and that's the wonderful thing about knowledge. You know, I started with this tour of a tower and wanted to find out why anyone had rebuilt this old tower, and ended up learning about World War II, about the airmail system, about early air navigation, about the tower industry, about the broadcast industry, about some of the concerns in the new cellular industry and the boom of the cellular industry and the problems that I know you and all of your workers and the people that follow your blog are all aware of, you know, that the unrealistic schedules and the explosion and of all these new towers going up at breakneck speed, putting, you know, extreme challenges in worker safety. So, you know, it started with a speck and turned into this just wonderful investigation of so much of American history.
I just can't believe in your book how many topics you cover. I know you concentrate on three stories individually, but
right.
You touch on so many things. And you even had that airline, the pilot who claimed he was the first guy, I guess he was the first guy that claimed he
was a navigator,
was
right?
Guy, yeah, navigator to work with radar, right?
He was Robert Dykus, and I chanced upon him in the nursing home where I taught an art class, and just happened to be talking about the struggles I was going through trying to find out about World War II navigation, and was directed, oh, you ought to talk to Bob Dykus. So I sit him down and start talking to him, and it turns out he's the first man in the entire, he said in the entire war, to use radar. I'm not sure if he meant Pacific Theater, but what he told me was the entire war, at one of the very first people trained in the use of radar. And then it turned out that he spent his whole life after the war working at WBT as an engineer. So mostly on the television side as opposed to the radio side, but he was fully aware of the towers. Yeah.
Wow. I mean, that's just so neat. I mean, so many stories you touch on, you know, it's just amazing. How long, forgetting the first 4 years where you lost the story and got it and found the note, How long did it take from that time until you actually completed the book?
3 years. And that was just, you know, and then, the last year, a lot of it was sending it to the major players in the book to be sure that I didn't say anything that embarrassed them. I wanted to talk about that. For one thing, I don't want to be sued. But for another thing, they became friends. And so I wanted to be sure everything that was in the book was accurate. So, and I'm so glad I did that for two reasons. Number one, Bob Dykus died before the book was published.
Yeah.
And but he did get to read his section.
Oh,
and as did another man that I met at the nursing home. Now he's still living, but he did get to read his section. And then Ted Bryan, who was the original WBT engineer that took me on the original tour of the towers, died before the book was published. But I was able to send him the section I wrote about him. And later on met his son, met his family. And they sent them a copy of the book and actually write a tribute to that. He was a wonderful man because the radio station was not at all thrilled for me to show up and tour their towers. And this wonderful engineer, Ted Bryan, was willing to volunteer and take me on a tour.
So how do you meet all these families? You become like a member of the family. So
right.
Christmas time, do you mail out 1,000 Christmas cards?
I do actually. I did mail out a lot to all of these wonderful people, especially Tony. And Tony, I made a very special card because I'm an artist. And so I worked with my paint program on my computer, and I made him standing in front of the Blaenau Towers and put a Christmas wreath, drew a Christmas wreath up on it and wrote him some verses. You wouldn't believe how many verses in the Bible talk about towers. There's hundreds of them. Sent that to him as a Christmas card. Yeah, they became very special. These experts I feel, you know, really connected to. They were so kind to me.
I just can't believe it. I mean, everyone you meet, I think it's great. Don't get me wrong. I mean, you keep in touch with everybody, and 3 years is a long time to put this book together. That's impressive, though, but you stuck with it. And the last chapter, like I said, I won't give it away because people are listening, but that last chapter was so amazing because everything just seemed to come together. I mean, it's so many stories that you finished them up. I thought beautifully. I love it.
Well, thank you. Well, I had one reviewer. There's a bunch of reviews up on Amazon, and one of them said the three stories seemed unconnected when she started reading. She's trying to figure out why on earth is she talking about these three different threads? Why aren't these three different books? And then you get to the last chapter, and it's like, oh, they all those threads miraculously come together. And yes, I agree. I loved the ending. Loved there's really, my brother told me I've really got three endings. There's three, like I guess one for each thread kind of, but three kind of exciting moments where there's an aha moment in it in my book where I've made some wonderful discovery.
It was so amazing. I'd like to talk about it, but I won't because I don't want to give it away. That last chapter, to me, the whole book was good. Don't get me wrong, Vicki. I loved your book, but the last chapter is just amazing how it all came together.
I know. I mean, there were literally parts where even now when I read them, I get chills and break into tears because, you know, I couldn't have made it up. I couldn't have made up a better story. This is completely true. Everything in this book really happened. And I actually was writing it as it was happening. I don't know if that's evident in the book, but and so for the 3 years of writing was because I'm actively researching, and every time I'd come across a clue, I would write a chapter or put it in the book. And in the end, I go back and do a lot of editing where I move things around so that it's easier for the reader to comprehend. But that's how the book was, the book was being written as I was discovering things. And I wanted the reader to walk through the mystery with me and to be trying to solve it himself as he's reading.
See, I did like that. That's what I liked about it, because you would drop clues and hints and let everyone know. And I also like that you still gave your opinion of what you were thinking at that time, because when you were pretty sure that that beacon was more than just a tower light, which it wasn't, it was on the roof of the building. But
right.
You were just so determined, because I forget who you were working with, but he kept saying that the beacons should be on the tower. And then was he the one that said they should be white? Should be a white beacon, not a red beacon.
Right.
I mean,
he told me, oh, you can't tell. Now, he was one that I annoyed. There were definitely times where I took him to the last millimeter of his patience, because I just would argue with him back and forth, email after email. And sometimes he would call me, and finally he kind of exploded. Where are you going with all this discourse? He said, you know, it's why do you care? And and then I said, well, you know, it started off about this tower rebuild, but then look at all I've learned. And I went through the list that I just told you and your listeners, and he paused, and all of a sudden he melted, and there was a change in his whole interactions with me at that point on. We were more a team then, and I think it's because he was the airmail beacon expert, and this is an obscure subject. Few people know about, not much information anymore left on it. Really got to dig into the archives, and he loves that. That's what he loves to do. So I think he saw a kindred spirit, and began to relate to me. And in fact, asked me if I would want to do a book where I would trace the airmail routes up the East Coast. I think the airmail beacon routes. And I don't know if I'll ever do that. I certainly love doing it for this book. It's one of those things in the back of my head. Maybe I will do now that I know I can research. But
3 years. Maybe you can do another 3 years.
oh, at least. Yes. Yeah. But I challenged him all the time, kept telling him. But I would find little snippets of documents that would counter what he was saying, and I would send it to him, and he would say they're incorrect. And he really stuck to his guns. So again, it wasn't until the final chapter. And then there's another thing that I won't divulge. When the chief engineer climbs up on the transmitter building, opens the beacon, and there's a big surprise.
Yeah.
So I won't tell your readers or your listeners what that is, because I'm hoping they'll buy the book to find out what that big surprise was.
And I will say one thing with that guy, just like you were saying, even though he was annoyed with you, and you could tell the guy was getting short, you know, his temper was getting short, he was just getting tired of it. But he stuck with you. I mean, you kept winning him over. He didn't bail. He didn't quit.
He didn't. And I would tell him repeatedly, I know I'm being a pest. And I know you're the expert. And believe me, I respect all that you're feeding me, all this knowledge. But just indulge me. This just doesn't make sense to me. I would see things that just didn't fit. And in the explanations that it was just either a tower, another tower light at some point. They told me it was just like a promotional beacon, like what used car lots used to draw people to. many people said it was a spotlight, which made zero sense to me. You know, a spotlight is a steady beam. Why would you have a rotating beacon? But that was the prevailing theory, was that it was a spotlight.
Anyone who's been to an AM tower site, I guarantee you they're sure that there's nothing promotional on an AM tower site. You know what I mean? Because back then, especially, you know, they're usually in the middle of fields on the outskirts of town. And the radio station, the last thing they want you to see is that tower site.
That's right. Yeah.
And that's why it's so funny, a promotional to me, you know, looking back at what I know. So.
Well, I'll tell you, you know, it's one of my most annoying traits is my persistence. I've been told many times to just lay off, back off. That's enough. I'm like a pit bull. But like with any negative character quality, there is oftentimes a positive side. and the positive side was, yes, I didn't give up until I solved it. I was determined I was going to solve every one of those mysteries.
Well, I will tell you this. You're very patient because, I mean, this is our third call. I hope it recorded all the way through this time, but God bless you, Vicki. Yeah, I hope so, but I do appreciate it. I really do, and I think everyone out there will appreciate, you know, all that you've done, and it is funny because I put notes about your book on my blog a week or two ago, but a guy got back to me and said, you know, she has nothing to do with the tower industry. I go, that's the point. It's an outsider's view, and she took the time to research it and the towers and the history,
right.
And I went on and on.
Right.
I mean, I didn't hear back from the guy, but
right.
I think in my industry, I think you will run up against that. Ah, she's never done this and she's never done that. But the point is, my perspective, you took the time to research it. You got to know Tony, and Tony sounds like an amazing guy. I mean, he just does. I mean,
right. Tony is. Tony's remarkable, and boy, if anyone knows the tower industry, Tony does. And that was part of what made Tony so remarkable is exactly what you said. Here I am, this yahoo from nowhere who has it, not only knows nothing about towers or the broadcast industry, but is terrified of heights, and he couldn't pay me enough to step one inch up a tower. And yet, he took 2 years out of his life, really. Just constantly being badgered by me. I was on him all the time. I was calling him all the time.
The great thing is that I want a lot of people to see, that my listeners anyway and my readers, Tony's life is a lot like a lot of these guys. You know, not everything goes great all the time. You have ups and downs. You know, he went through his divorce and, you know, it explains a lot. You know, he had to move out in that apartment. I know you talk about a lot of his wife, and thank God he maintained that great relationship with his daughter. I mean, his family sounds amazing and all that, but he goes through a lot of the parallels that a lot of people in this industry go through because, and you and I have discussed it before about all the travel. The guy travels every week of the year, or, you know, I shouldn't say every week of the year, but for work, it's almost every week of the year.
Yeah,
it's just a tremendous strain on your personal life. So it's amazing the guy could pull it all back together, and you know, just like I said, you got to read the last chapter. The ending's great.
yeah, that's right. He it not only is the family life, you know, I think the balance is very difficult to maintain, at least from Tony's experience, which is the one that I knew most about. But and we talked about this, that his beloved Klein Towers, the company that was just the Cadillac of the tower industry, went through various acquisitions and just kept getting further and further from the excellent traditions that had made them so such a wonderful company. And Tony weathered those acquisitions and stayed with them until he just couldn't stand it anymore, because he saw them dissolving coincidentally at the same point that his marriage was dissolving. And so a big part of my book is the parallel between not only the dissolution of his life, his career, but when the towers that I was researching were knocked down by Hurricane Hugo, you know, the fact that they were destroyed. And much of the book is, how do you rebuild? And really, and I think this is kind of the human element of the story, how do you rebuild without blueprints? He didn't have blueprints, and I love, really, honestly, it's my favorite part of the book. He rebuilds the towers without blueprints, but he also, none of us are given blueprints for our life, for our marriage, for how to raise children. You know, we're all winging it. We're all trying to figure it out as we go along, and we make a lot of mistakes. And you see the same thing that in a tower, if one bolt is off, if the structure is not sound, if the foundation is not sound, everything falls apart. And it's true for towers, it's true for marriages, it's true for spiritual growth, it's true for families. So, you know, it was kind of my book, what I really wanted it to be was, yes, it's about towers, but it is a universal story.
I thought it was great. And in, like I said, in the industry, the parallels between everyone's life and Tony's life are amazing. I told you before about the, you know, companies get taken over, they shut down, they start over, guys are looking for work, and their families, you know, it's hard when you travel all the time, and their families. So, yeah, I just thought your book was great. So thank you for writing it, Vicki. Thank you.
Thank you so much for being so enthusiastic about it. I can't tell you how wonderful and encouraging that is to any author, but after all this work, and I really appreciate it.
After 3 years of work, God bless you. For crying out loud, 3 years of research, and you stuck with it. I mean, it's so impressive. It really is. I know it sounds like I'm just saying that, but I know how much, you know, I put together technical manuals, technical books. I can't imagine taking 3 years to put it together. That's
right.
Incredible. I think it's great, and you did a great job. So,
you
kudos.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
All right, Vicki, I'll let you go, and thank you so much. And, again, I appreciate your patience. Thank you for putting up with me for
you are so welcome. It's been a joy to talk to you. And if this recording doesn't work, just call me back. Not a problem.
Oh, I hope it works this time.
Okay.
All right,
Wade. Well, you take care, too. Thank you so much. Bye-bye now.
Okay, everybody. So you heard Vicki's interview, and you heard how nice and sweet she is. I mean, just like I said, wonderful to be around, a real joy. And thank you for sticking through this. I didn't think my files would be so big, and I apologize. I'm sure most of you understand out there. I have a limitation on what I can and cannot upload. But anyway, I think just reading, I just enjoyed the book, okay? I just did. I enjoyed reading about the towers and everything. And then after talking to Vicki, you know, she's the type of person that would stick with something all the way to the end and make sure it's seen through to the end. And I'm sure most of you can appreciate that. When you work on a project, no one likes to quit in the middle. There are times you want to quit in the middle. Don't get me wrong. There are times when you're just fed up with stuff. But you can't give up. For one, you don't get paid if you just quit in the middle. You lose money. I mean, that's just the reality of the business, okay? I'm not saying anything out of line there. I'm just pointing things out. But with Vicki, you know, she was just so passionate about the story. She wanted to see it through to the end. And it was really her brother that started the whole thing, you know, a ham guy. These ham radio guys, you know, they just become obsessed with things, which is why they're in ham radio, the amateur radio. And I put a few links in my blog for the ARRL, Amateur Radio Relay League. I hope I said that right. But if you're interested in becoming a hamster, there you go. I mean, it's a fun thing to do. I have a lot of friends that do it. You have your call sign, and a lot of guys, when you're driving around, not to take the subject off of Vicki's book. I loved her book, by the way. It's on Amazon. I highly recommend everyone get it. But the hamsters are call signs. If you see somebody's license plate that says something like W3DG10 most of them are W3F113, something like that. It's usually five or six numbers, and I know those hamsters are going to give me a hard time, but a lot of times for their license plate, they'll put their call sign. When you get emails from these guys, you'll see their call sign. So one of these days, I guess I should talk to one of these hamsters about that and about the details. And I know they have the contests where, you know, in amateur, you know, you have different wavelength radios. You know, they have 3 meter and 1 meter and things like that. And that's usually how they talk about the radios. They don't necessarily get into frequency. I'm a frequency guy. You know, I need megahertz, gigahertz. they do it by wavelength and meters. And they're really interesting guys. But the big contest is who you talk to and the farthest person you talk to, because at night there's conditions where they can bounce off the clouds, and someone in the U.S. can speak to someone in Japan or Russia or all around the world. And anyway, just a note about hamsters. Back to Vicki, though. Sorry, it's all about Vicki. I don't know what I was thinking. I got off track there. I just really enjoyed having her. I want to thank her, which I did, and she was so patient with all my problems. I just couldn't believe all the technical problems I had. You know, I just, recording issues, phone issues, is one thing after another, and God bless her, she stuck until the end. So, she probably would have let me call back, so, and you could hear in the call, she's so friendly and open and pretty honest about everything. All right, you guys take care. I have another special guest coming up I want to tell everyone about. Bruce Holsted, is a guy I wrote about before that had Rocky Mountain spotted fever. And I actually interviewed him from the time I did this yesterday. It's I think today's June 28th. So he's just a great guy. He really is. And I just want to give you a little teaser there. He actually lost a lot of let's say, time out of his life because of this disease. This disease was just crippling to him, literally crippling. And we go into it in the call, and there is a way to prevent tick bites. There is something you can put on, and I'm going to tell it to you now. It's permethrin. I won't have the links in this blog, but I will have them in the blog about Bruce. And I just didn't know about it when I interviewed Kevin Kidd. Remember, he had Rocky Mountain spotted fever as well, all from a tick bite. Anyway, I'll let you guys go. I just want to make sure that I want to make sure that I thank you for sticking through these calls. I appreciate it. And after hearing Vicky, you can hear how pleasant she is. All right. You guys, take care. Remember, be smart. Be careful and pay attention. I got that from the book, from Tony in the book. Pay attention. Pay attention to what you're doing, to what you're supposed to be doing, and to what needs to be done. Because if you pay attention to safety, all the rest will fall in place. All right. Thanks, guys. Be safe.